namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Dana dharman raja dharman. Moksha dharman vibhagashaha. Stri dharman bhagavad dharman. Samasa vyasa yogataha. Dana dharman raja dharman. Moksha dharman vibhagashaha. Stri dharman bhagavad dharman. Samasa vyasa yogataha. Dana dharman. The acts of charity. Raja dharman. Pragmatic activities of the kings. Moksha dharman. The acts for salvation. Vibhagashaha. By divisions. Stri dharman. Duties of women. Bhagavat dharman. The acts of the devotees. Samasa. Generally. Vyasa. Explicitly. Yogataha. By means of. Translation in purport by Srila Prabhupada. He then explained, by divisions, acts of charity, the pragmatic activities of a king, and activities for salvation. Then he described the duties of women and devotees, both briefly and extensively. Purport. To give charity is one of the householder's main functions. To give charity is one of the householder's main functions. And he should be prepared to give in charity at least 50% of his hard-earned money. A brahmachari or student should perform sacrifices. A householder should give charity. And a person in the retired life or in the renounced order should practice penances and austerities. Those are the general functions of all the ashramas or orders of life on the path of self-realization. In the brahmachari life, the training is sufficiently imparted so that one may understand that the world, as property, belongs to the Supreme Lord, the personality of Godhead. No one, therefore, can claim to be the proprietor of anything in the world. Therefore, in the life of a householder, which is a sort of license for sex enjoyment, one must give in charity for the service of the Lord. Everyone's energy is generated by generated or borrowed from the reservoir of energy of the Lord. Therefore, the resultant actions of such energy must be given to the Lord in the shape of transcendental loving service for him. As the rivers draw water from the sea through the clouds, and again go down to the sea. Similarly, our energy is borrowed from the supreme source, the Lord's energy, and it must return to the Lord. That is the perfection of our energy. The Lord, therefore, in the Bhagavad Gita says that whatever we do, whatever we undergo as penance, whatever we sacrifice, whatever we eat, or whatever we give in charity must be offered to him, the Lord. That is the way of utilizing our borrowed energy. When our energy is utilized in that way, our energy is purified from the contamination of material inebrieties, and thus we become fit for our original natural life of service to the Lord. Rajadharma is a great science. Unlike modern diplomacy for political supremacy, the kings were trained systematically to become munificent and not merely be tax collectors. They were trained to perform different sacrifices for the prosperity of the subjects. To lead the prajas to the attainment of salvation was a great duty of the king. The father, the spiritual master, and the king are not to become irresponsible in the matter of leading their subjects to the path of ultimate liberation from birth, death, diseases, and old age. When these primary duties are properly discharged, there is no need of government of the people by the people. In modern days, the people in general occupy the administration by the strength of manipulated votes. But they are never trained in the primary duties of the king. And that is also not possible for everyone. Under the circumstances, the untrained administrators play havoc to make the subjects happy in all respects. On the other hand, these untrained administrators gradually become rogues and thieves and increase the taxation to finance a top-heavy administration that is useless for all purposes. Actually, the qualified Brahmins are meant to give direction to the kings for proper administration in terms of the scriptures like the Manu Samhita and the Dharma Shastras of Parashara. A typical king is the ideal of the people in general. And if the king is pious, religious, chivalrous, and munificent, the citizens generally follow him. Such a king is not a lazy, sensuous person living at the cost of the subjects, but alert always to kill thieves and dacoits. The pious kings were not merciful to dacoits and thieves in the name of nonsensical ahimsa, nonviolence. The thieves and dacoits were punished in an exemplary way so that in the future no one would dare commit such nuisances in an organized form. Such thieves and dacoits were never meant for administration as they are now. The taxation law was simple. There was no force, no encroachment. The king had a right to take one-fourth of the production made by the subject. The king had a right, one would never grudge parting with it, because due to the pious king and religious harmony, There was enough natural wealth, namely grains, fruits, flowers, silk, cotton, milk, jewels, minerals, etc. And therefore no one was materially unhappy. The citizens were rich in agriculture and animal husbandry, and therefore they had enough grains, fruits, and milk without any artificial needs of soaps and toilets, cinemas, and bars. Bhishma Dev is speaking as a great expert on the organization of the human society by the principles of Varnashrama that is taught in the Vedas. There are particular books, the Dharma Shastras, that systematically present under particular chapters, the different branches, the different divisions of dharmas for different classes of people. But actually, all these principles, all the basic principles, maybe not all the details, but all the basic principles are found presented in the original Vedas. In the Rig Veda and the other Vedas, there are so many pieces of information that if you put them all together, you would get a pretty much complete picture of the Varnashram system. Just as not presented in the Vedas, not presented systematically. That is organized by various rishis in the Dharma Shastras, which first were written in the form of sutras. There were Dharma Sutras. Just like in the Vedic tradition, the performance of sacrifice is explained in the Brahmanas, which are original Shrutis, how to use the mantras of the Samhitas for performing a yajna is explained in the Brahmanas. And the Brahmanas also explain the meaning of the sacrifice, the history of it and the purpose of it. This is part of the Vedas, of the Shruti. But especially after Treta Yuga, that was not enough information for people to understand exactly how to perform sacrifice. So various sages at different times wrote their commentaries in the forms of sutras. And so you have different versions written by different rishis for different shakas of different Vedas. The Shrauta Sutras, the Grihya Sutras, and the Dharma Sutras, three kinds. There are those sacrifices that are directly enjoined in the Shruti. And these are major, important sacrifices, public sacrifices. And then there are private sacrifices to be performed by householders in their own houses, by themselves, and including the samskaras of family life. So the public major sacrifices that are directly presented in the Shruti, these are explained by the sages in their Shrauta Sutras. And the private sacrifices, the home sacrifices, and the samskaras are explained in the Grihya Sutras. And then there's the third category, the Dharma Sutras, that explain the Varnashram Dharma in sutra form. That was the standard literary form at that stage. And then later on, they were rewritten by other sages in the form of shlokas, the Dharma Shastras. Dharma Shastra includes both, but there's the sutras and then there's smritis. The smritis are written by many sages. There are 57 standard smritis, and they're in verse form. And they explain in ordinary language that less educated Brahmins can easily understand the same principles of Varnashram Dharma, as were previously described in the Dharma Sutras. Prabhupada mentions here the Manu Samhita and the Dharma Shastra of Parashara. So these are two smritis written by two sages. There are many others, 57 that we have in our collection, our library. We have all 57 and a few more. And some of the old Dharma Sutras we have also. These principles of Dharma are quite complicated. especially because human society is divided up and there's different laws, different responsibilities and privileges for different classes of people, and it gets complicated. Bhishma is a great expert on all that complication. Some knowledge tends towards simplification. Just like modern physics is an attempt to explain everything according to, you know, the grand field theory in four formulas, if possible, explain the whole universe. That's a kind of knowledge, mathematical analysis, that tries to simplify everything into a few formulas. But there's other kinds of knowledge that has to deal in details. And the details get more and more complex as you extend the analysis. Just like we're reading Kavya Shastra. It's not that there's four, you know, grand rules of Kavya and everything sticks to them. No, there's hundreds of subdivisions and thousands of subdivisions and different things to understand that can't even be formulated in rules. It's just, well, it comes down to just getting a feel of it. So that's complicated detail knowledge. And the Dharma Shastra is in that category. There's no, you know, not even 10 commandments. There's thousands of commandments, and the commandments are different for each class of people. That is material life. Material life is complicated, especially if you want to live it lawfully. If you want to be a good person, then life is complicated. If you don't care about being a good person, then life can be a little simpler. You can live like an animal and just go where your nose smells a fragrance, run after it. But if you want to live a civilized life, it gets complicated. So many rules. In the Jewish religion, which is more karmakanda than ours, there's what they call mitzvahs, or, rules. Do's and don'ts. How many are there? 700 and something. Yeah. And if you don't follow all of them, you're not a good Jew. Of course, a lot are not good Jews. They don't even know, they don't even care what they are. But the really serious Jews, they're scholars, and they study all these mitzvahs, and they're really worried about obeying all of them. So it's practically like that for the Brahmins, especially, who try to follow the Dharma Shastras. Brahmins have a lot of rules to follow. What to do if you accidentally touch your ear, you know, what do you have to do to atone for it? Or you know, there's so many things. And for the Kshatriyas, it's also quite complicated. It's not as complicated as Brahminical regulation, but the regulation for a Kshatriya is also, especially, it's dealing with politics. It was controlling other people and sometimes killing other people. So it's also a mess, complicated. It's not only complicated, it's bloody. So many rules for the Kshatriyas. And that is Raja Dharma that we're reading about now. Life can be simpler. Those who have love of God, they only have field theory of four rules, only one rule. Make Krishna happy. Those who are ruled by love don't have to follow or even pay attention to so many rules. Their only rule is to make Krishna satisfied. And they just know by their transcendental instinct. Prabhupada argues against animals actually having instinct. He says, no, this is a fiction, a myth. They're ruled by their conditioning. But instinct is just a made-up conception. You know, that their genes are programming them. Anyway, there's a spiritual kind of instinct that those who have love for Krishna possess. They just know what to do and how to do it based on the imperative that I have to make Krishna happy. They just naturally know how to do it. According to their own rasa, they naturally know how to serve Krishna, what to do and what not to do. Nobody has to tell them. Like there are things that our parents had to tell us how to do, and there are other things that just, when our hormones dictated to us, we knew how to do without our parents telling us. So like that, there are spiritual instincts for those who possess prema. They don't have to be instructed by Shastra or anybody else what to do. But for those who don't have love, there are rules. And you have to learn them out of books. And you have to accept teachers and be respectful to your teachers and learn from them what to do. Even for us, we're practicing pure devotional service. But we're doing it according to Vaidhi Bhakti, Vidhi, rules. We have to follow some rules. Not as many rules or as ridiculous, senseless, and complicated rules as the karmis have to follow. But we have our rules. Now, we have a unified field theory. No meat eating, no intoxication, no gambling, you know, no illicit sex. That is the, you know, the basic rules and chant Hare Krishna. It's not a lot of rules, but the rules are important. The process doesn't work without following the rules. But we're working not to just forever be rule-bound. We don't love the rules for their own sake. We're not following the rules just because that's our duty, to follow rules. We're following the rules to awaken love of God in our hearts so that we don't have to follow the rules anymore, or at least not think about them. In the beginning of the Dharma Shastra, Jaimini defines, well, the first sutra is Atato Dharma Gigyasa. Now we should inquire. Now that we're human beings, we should inquire. What is Dharma? What is our duty? What is Dharma, though? Well, Dharma is defined in the next sutra. Dharma Chodana Lakshana. Dharma is defined as what you're told to do, Chodana. What you're told to do, and that's explained, what you're told to do in the Vedas, what the Vedas tell you to do. That's your Dharma. So that's a mundane conception of duty, of Dharma. We're practicing Bhagavad Dharma. That's on the list here. Sri Dana Dharman, Raja Dharman, Moksha Dharman for the mumukshus, Sri Dharman for the women and those who deal with women. Even a sannyasi should be aware, because, you know, he's a sannyasi, but, you know, half the people in the world are women. He may run into a few women once in a while. So he has to know what to do with them, even a sannyasi. What to do with them, what not to do with them. Otherwise, you know, Rishi Sringa's father tried to train him up never to see a woman and not know what a woman is. But because he didn't learn Sri Dharma, he didn't learn what women are, others were able to take advantage of him by alluring him with women. He didn't know the rules about what to do and what not to do with women, so he followed his instincts and wasn't able to maintain his brahmacharya. Bhagavad Dharman is on the list after Sri Dharma. It's not last on the list, but not least. It's just that most people are too busy with the other dharmas to be able to even get to Bhagavad Dharma. So therefore, it's last on the list. The smallest minority of the population is seriously involved in Bhagavad Dharma. Because those who are engrossed in the Sri Dharma and the Dana Dharma and the Raja Dharma and the Moksha Dharma can't give their attention fully, properly, to Bhagavad Dharma. So it's last on the list. And it's the least described. When you look at the volume of the Vedic literature, Bhagavad Dharma is not, especially pure Bhagavad Dharma, not mixed, but pure Bhagavad Dharma, pure Shuddha Bhakti is described not very frequently, not in much of the Vedic literature. Srila Sanatana Goswami lists the books that present Shuddha Bhakti, and it's a short list. Of course, the Bhagavatam, some of the other Puranas, like the Vishnu Purana, and some parts of a few Puranas, like the Skanda Purana and Padma Purana, some parts of them present Shuddha Bhakti. A few, very few Upanishads present Shuddha Bhakti. Other Upanishads present Jnana Mishra or Karma Mishra Bhakti. Shvetashvatara Upanishad presents Jnana Mishra Bhakti. Kato Upanishad presents Karma Mishra Bhakti. Shuddha Bhakti is only presented in the Gopal Tapani and a few other Upanishads. A few other Upanishads. And that's practically the whole list. course, there are later derivative books written by later authorities on Shuddhabhakti, but the original books, that's a short list. Because there is not a big audience for it. In the book publishing business, if you're actually trying to make some money and not just throw money away, you have to consider who's going to buy these books before you publish. Even the BBT cannot publish books unless their customers are going to use them. In other words, the book distributors, who are the customers for the BBT, have to have a demand for books. Otherwise, BBT is out of business. The BBT depends on the demand from their customers, from the book distributors. And they publish what the book distributors want. They follow the dictates of the customers. In practice, someone donated money 15 years ago to publish books in Icelandic. 100,000 Isha Upanishads, which were translated, 100,000 copies were printed. But very few of them were ever distributed. They're still sitting in the warehouse. 100,000 Icelandic Isha Upanishads. Until someone actually seriously starts distributing those books in Iceland. Anybody want to go? Iceland. The BBT is not going to seriously consider publishing the other books in Icelandic until somebody starts selling the ones we have. There has to be a demand for books, and then they'd be published. So also, Vyasadeva and his co-workers, they presented what the audience wanted. And it wasn't much a demand for Shuddhabhakti, and therefore it's not described in many books because of lack of demand. It's the most important, but until people start seriously giving attention, enough people to be able to make a profit, show serious interest in Shuddhabhakti, the publishers aren't going to produce much. It's said that Vyasadeva, of course, Vyasadeva came as Vrindavan Das Thakur and described the leelas of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the Chaitanya Bhagavat. And there he predicts that Vyasadeva will come back again and describe much more of the leelas of Mahaprabhu in the future. Why in the future? Why not now? Because there's not enough demand. When the audience is asking for it, then Vyasadeva will come back and write, you know, sequels to the Chaitanya Bhagavat. So we're indebted to Vyasadeva and the other sages who are giving this shastra, and our duty to them is to stimulate the demand so that they'll give us more. Not that, oh, we got everything already. We got our library. We got our list of books, and they were all written millions of years ago. But we want more books. Okay, let me read the rest of the purport about Raja Dharma. Prabhupada says, continuing, the king had to see that the reserved energy of humanity was properly utilized. Reserved energy. See, this is when, in the known history of Western civilization, civilization supposedly, this is what they teach us in school, began in Mesopotamia and Egypt. Mesopotamia is Iraq. Believe it or not, civilization began in Iraq. It seems like it's going to end in Iraq too. Anyway, because they had fertile land there. Although Egypt's in the middle of a desert, it's got the Nile River, and the Nile floods every spring. And the land around the Nile is very fertile after the floods. And Mesopotamia is between pota, means water in Greek. So Mesopotamia is between the waters, Doab, you know, between the Jumna and the Ganga. But they have two rivers there, the Euphrates and the whatever the other one is. And between those two rivers, very fertile land. They can grow more than they need to feed the populace. There's a surplus. They grow more than they need. And when that happens, the kingly class can live in luxury and maintain in luxury the priestly class, and modern civilization, as we know it, develops on the basis of kingdoms. But that's only when there's surplus. Otherwise, it's, you know, survival farming and bare minimum and nation states don't develop. They develop when there's a surplus. And then you have to go conquer the world to get a market for your products. So the king is there to see that the reserved energy, that means the surplus, of humanity was properly utilized. Human energy is meant not exactly for fulfilling animal propensities, but for self-realization. The whole government was specifically designed to fulfill this particular purpose. As such, the king had to select properly his the cabinet ministers, but not on the strength of voting background. The ministers, the military commanders, and even the ordinary soldiers were all selected by personal qualification. And the king had to supervise them properly before they were appointed to their respective posts. The king was especially vigilant to see that the tapasvis, or persons who sacrificed everything for disseminating spiritual knowledge, were never disregarded. The king knew well, this is italics, the king knew well that the Supreme Personality of Godhead never tolerates any insult to his unalloyed devotees. Such tapasvis were trusted leaders, even of the rogues and thieves, who would never disobey the orders of tapasvis. The king would give special protection to the illiterates, the helpless, and the widows of the state. Defense measures were arranged previous to any attack by the enemies. The taxing process was easy, and it was not meant for squandering, but was for strengthening the reserve fund. The soldiers were recruited from all parts of the world, and they were trained for special duties. Okay. Well, let's try to finish it. Now, let's stop. There's three more paragraphs. Maybe someone can cover them tomorrow. About Moksha Dharma and Sri Dharma and Bhagavad Dharma. So that can be tomorrow's class. Any questions or comments? Yes. It's okay, just,
For the karmis, you mentioned that there are so many complicated rules and regulations, and for those who are interested in devotional service, there is not so many complicated rules and regulations. So could we say that excessive complication and excessive detail of the rules and regulations that are there for the karmis, that is to just keep them engaged under the stipulations of shastras, so that if they are left free, then they'll use the time to do self-destructive things. So if they are kept engaged by the rules and regulations, then they will be at least kept busy.
Well, you can keep a person busy with simple principles if they follow them. Just like if you're trying to get a child, keep him engaged. You don't confuse him with a lot of rules. You just tell him, here, do this, one or two things. So childless people actually can only think about one or two things at a time anyway. It's really for the more intelligent and more educated people, the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, that there's so many rules. The rules for Vaishyas and Shudras, what is given in the Dharma Shastras, in say the Manusmriti, the rules for the Vaishyas and Shudras, almost nothing. I think at the end of one chapter, both are described. What the Vaishyas have to do and what the Shudras have to do. Very simple for them. So it's more that people have to be engaged appropriately. And for to be a Brahmin in the material world or to be a king in the material world is complicated. There are a lot of things to consider and consider carefully and properly. So it's more that the duties actually are complicated for the higher classes. Otherwise, the pedagogical principle would be keep it simple, especially for simple people. Just tell them to do one or two things and make sure they do it. Have sanctions ready. If they don't do it, something happens to them. And it's, you know, kept simple.
But if you speak in the realm of daily activities that they have to do, like even taking bath, that's made complicated.
But not for Shudras. Shudras is you're lucky if he takes a bath. Yeah.
So that understanding then is, it's not so appropriate to say that all the rituals that are given, say even for planting things in the farm, then there are so many worships before sowing the seed.
Well, rituals. They just, the pundit in the village tells them, okay, time to do puja. They don't have to worry about it. The pundits tell them. What I'm wondering is, they're harvesting the wheat in the fields now. How do they know exactly when the wheat's ready? Does anybody know? I mean, it keeps on growing. When do you know to stop and cut it down? Is it calculated according to a certain day, or they look for something? I guess so. But the farmers have to know that kind of thing. When the wheat's ready to cut. That's the kind of thing a farmer has to know. As far as when to do a ritual, the Brahmins will tell them that. They pay the Brahmins for that.
The very fact that they are asked to do those rituals, is that just to keep them busy?
Well, it's part of it. But, I mean, the rituals have their own value. It's offering to the demigods. It's completing the ecology of the universe. You don't just keep it for yourself. You offer it to the gods. Then you're not just a thief. Tairadatana padayebhyo yobhukte stena evasa. If you don't, you're getting from the demigods. They poured down the water. They let the seeds grow. They gave the sunlight and the wind by which your wheat grew. Now you have to offer it back to them. Otherwise, you're a thief. So there's that much more to it. That's being a civilized human being. When you offer back to those who give to you, to your parents, your teachers, the demigods, when you make some sort of offering back to them, then you're a civilized, decent human being. Otherwise, you're ungrateful. You're a thief. So, I mean, it's basic human education, even for the low-class people, to be decent and show a little bit of gratitude. Okay. Matsuhiro?
I'm just wondering what the main differences are between, Dharma Shastra and Niti Shastra and Artha Shastra.
Okay. Niti Shastra and Artha Shastra. Niti Shastra is the name for Artha Shastra. The Dharma Shastras were studied and taught by the Brahmins. They're books for Brahmins. The Artha Shastras teach almost the same things, or a subset of the Dharma Shastra information, but it's written for kings. The Artha Shastra, the audience, were the kings. The kings studied the Artha Shastras, which were just selections of the rules of the Dharma Shastras that pertain to their duties. A Brahmin and a Kshatriya are both interested in protecting religion, but they have different ways of doing it. The Brahmin protects religion by knowing all the principles and teaching them to others, advising others. The king maintains Dharma by getting power and keeping it. So the main thing that's taught by the Artha Shastra, although it's based on the Dharma Shastra, is simply how to get power and maintain it according to the principles of religion. So that the Kshatriyas have that special interest, so there's a special subset of the Dharma Shastra is presented as the Artha Shastra for them.
They're like a derivative of the Dharma Shastras that kind of came later? Or?
We can say derivative, yeah. First of all, there's a cycle. In every age, new Dharma Shastras are written. So you can say that it's natural that subsequent to the Dharma Shastra in each age will come the Artha Shastra, yes. Like the only Artha Shastra we know about in our age is the one written by Chanakamuni. And he lived maybe 1000 BC, not that old. Yes. The Bhagavatam says 1000 BC. So there's different opinions about that. There's the historical opinion and there's the Shastric opinion about when he lived. Yes? Yeah. Because there's practical things that people who want to become civilized, barbarians would like to become civilized, could learn a lot from Janakamuni. So therefore Prabhupada, for us barbarians who are trying to become civilized, he taught us these basic principles of how to be a decent human being. And they're taught in very simple form by Chanaka in his shlokas. He didn't teach us Manusmriti, he didn't translate it, or even he discouraged one Madhaji, I don't know who she was, wrote a letter to Prabhupada, you know, we're thinking in our center to study the Manusmriti and implement it. And Prabhupada wrote back to her and says, you read Manusmriti, you'll go to hell. Because it wasn't appropriate. You know, what is she going to get out of Manusmriti? You'll misunderstand everything and make a mess of it. So, but the simple version that's just these pithy aphorisms given to us by Chanaka Muni, we can understand them. You know, a son should be a devotee and a pundit, otherwise he's just, the putra is just mutra. So he learned things like that. Okay. The sun and the urine both come from the same place. So the sun isn't a scholar and a devotee, then he's just as good as urine. And Prabhupada said basis of human civilization is to understand that all women but your wife should be treated as mother. So that's all from Chanaka. I mean, that's also taught by Manu. It's also there in the Vedas. But Chanaka Muni put it in, you know, a nice verse that we can easily remember. Okay, we have to stop. Thank you. All glory to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.